Hey everybody, I thought it might be interesting for you, and I know it would be good for me to share a little bit what life was like in Eretz Yisrael on and after October 7th, and I'm sure you heard a lot about it already, but as both a resident and a reshiva, perhaps I can add something beneficial. That was the angle, that's why I engaged in this talk. And I know it's good for me to be able to organize my thoughts and feelings a little, and if nothing else, a member of Klal Yisrael, who Klal Yisrael is going through a lot, so it's a time when we have to get together. Family gets together in times of difficulty. So it's still a time of difficulty, and Bezrat Hashem, the Rabbanu Shem will be happy with our efforts. Just for context, I mean, you guys mostly know me, right? I'm a schoolmaker. How old am I? 55. That feels old, you know. I don't say that in yeshiva. And I taught at Ishtar in the past, and now I, of course, in Chappelle's, and that's why I came to YU. To try to bring Talmidim to Chappelle's, etc. So I want to speak openly and honestly. We're celebrating Simchas Torah in Beit HaKerem. That's where the Yeshiva is, you know, Jerusalem. And it is celebrated in Yeshiva, a beautiful time, right? Simchas Torah in Yeshiva is a special. The night of Hakafas, and the Yeshiva was particularly Leibedik. It was beautiful, very heartsick, very awake and stuff like that. As I hadn't remembered that. I wouldn't say I blocked it out because of traumatic reasons, but who thought about what Simchas Torah night was like? But as I was preparing this little talk, I was trying to review, and I said, "Oh, that was a particular Leibedik time." And since we're a small yeshiva, it is not always that way. It's not always Leibedik at night. It was not always so lively at night. So, and of course, Simchas Torah Shmini Atzeres, as you know, is one of the holiest times of the year, one of the highest times of the year. It's during the silence, and we're now. So that was the night. We're now Shacharis. Simchas Torah morning in Yerushalayim. And in the middle of the silent Shemon Esrei, middle of the silent prayer, you hear the sirens, first sirens. And sirens? Is that really a siren? At first you're not sure. Then you are sure. No, that was a siren. I've been in Israel for other wars. I got married during the war. I got married during the Gulf War. Remember. So now what? Hear a siren in Mil Shemon Esrei. I'm sure it's a siren. Now what? Remember, we all know, in retrospect, we know everything. But back then, we know nothing. It's a siren. Okay, you know what a siren means, but what does it really mean? It's a siren. Should I stop Shemon Esrei? Should I get the yeshiva to stop? Should I continue? So I decided to continue with Shemon Esrei. I kept going. Afterwards, I conferred with Rabbi Kalinsky, my fellow yeshiva, and actually hadn't even heard the first sirens. He wasn't so early. He heard it a little bit, wasn't sure, but he definitely was not clear. And I and Rabbi Lerner said, no, that was definitely a siren. So what should we do if there's more? What do we do if there are more sirens? Send our yeshiva, as you know, has a wonderful custom of joining all once a year, really it's only once a year, that we do something with the greater Beit HaKerem community, three or four shuls to get together in Kikar Denya, in the central plaza there. And, okay, so what do we do if there are more sirens? Well, how do we play this? What's going to be with the outside hakafa there? Can we do that? If there will be a siren, do we go? Anyway, one decision we made that was that if sirens happen, we'll finish Shemon Esrei for most of, but really it was now with long hakafa, so we said we'll go into the miklat. We have a miklat. You guys been in the miklat? You ever there? I don't know if I was ever there, but... So we're going to go to the mikvah for the hakafas. And we continue davening. Not very concerned. I wouldn't say at this point we're very concerned. And we start the hakafas. And then more sirens. A lot more sirens. And they start coming. And I was zochet to take the yeshiva through COVID together with others. And I said, I can handle this. You know, that's what leadership is all about, dealing with. Leadership is all about dealing with slightly difficult situations. Welcome, right? And it might even be an advantage. You know, you always have to know. You always have to play things to your advantage. So it could be maybe going through the Chavrusa. Yes. Oh, welcome.
Thanks for coming. My brother-in-law is in Chabrusa.
Oh, really? Whoa. Nice. That means you're he's Sabrina. Married to your sister.
Yes, Sabrina is.
Beautiful. Wow. Welcome. Very cool. I saw them recently. Oh, yeah. I ran to them. Yep. So you know, it might be an advantage. Maybe it'd be like cool and hip to have Hakavus in the miklat. You never know. So we did continue. Every time there was a siren, if there was a siren during the hakafas, we moved into the miklat, and we finished the hakafa in the miklat, and then we would move back and start a new hakafa. That's how we did it. which and it worked. And then certain Talmidim getting nervous. We're saying Hoshi Esamecha, Hoshi Esamecha. But more or less, because remember that we know nothing really what's going on in the greater. None of our people, some of the Chilonim by that point, had some idea of going on. Hatzalah people had, the army people going on. But the yeshiva, we had no one connected to anything. We have no idea really what's going on. Obviously, it's clear at this point that we're not going to go. A kabbas will go on, Davin will go on. We're not going to go to Kikar Denya. We join the other communities for a central dance in the plaza. That's not happening. But nervousness is rising. And then you start to hear reports trickle in a little bit. Rabbi Lerner, who was a connector, so he ran into a Chiloni neighbor and said there was an infiltration in the south, 2030 terrorists, something like that. That was, which is, you know, 2030 terrorists, you have to appreciate that. Those have been in Israel. Like hearing 2030, any terrorists in the country, I don't remember ever hearing of a terrorist loose in the country besides, I don't remember, like, you hear that he's like running around. You know, you hear there was a terrorist and they've taken care of where he did his dastardly deed. But the fact that there's a situation of like running around unchecked, unfinished business, that sounds like, I don't remember ever such a thing. Obviously, there are many terrorist acts in Israel, but that it's unfinished, never, it's just not, speaking to you guys right now, I don't remember ever such a thing. Okay, but it can't be. But despite those initial reports, the Yom Tov continue. We had a nice Suda, continued as well. And of course, then Motzi Shabbos, you check the news, and the numbers of dead are skyrocketing. You know the rest. I want to share a few words, which you might not know, about the magnitude of what happened. Just, like I said, I'm trying to give my perspective and my reflection to someone who was there, living through it, thinking about it, and trying to guide yeshiva through it. So, you know, 1,400 dead, 1,200, whatever the exact number is, 250 hostages. But you have to understand that wasn't the real number. That's not the real number in a certain way. Why? Because we know two things now that we didn't know then, and you might not have be aware of it. That although from an overall view, it was certainly one of the darkest days, if not the darkest day, in Israeli military history, because it was a breakdown on all levels. You know, heads will roll when they really figure out when it's all over. They certainly should roll, you know, and they will roll, you know, because it's just unfathomable from a perspective. $2 million wall or whatever it is, and a great army against, like, what happened? It was hours and hours until things reached itself. That's on one level. But on an individual heroism level, I'm convinced it's one of the greatest days of modern Jewish history. In the overall army day, terrible. Individual heroism, unparalleled. There were so many special forces, regular chayalim, police officers, civilians. Rav Shatz, we'll get back to that. What we call kita konanut, people in the kibbutzim were defending, and with unbelievable heroism. We'll talk about some of it later that I heard firsthand. That was unbelievable. But what that means, b'derech hateva, you know, in the ways we don't go darchei shamayim, but what we see, that means if it hadn't been for all those things, the numbers would have been skyrocketed much, 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 much higher. It wasn't that, you know, this was the idea. It was a guy with a knife who's going to stab a few people, get killed, or blow up a few people. Without those guys, without those hundreds and hundreds of efforts, and, you know, I suggest if you haven't seen them, it's fitting to see some of the interviews, the number would have been infinitely higher. You know, but much higher. That's one thing. We also know their plans. The plan was to go into Ashkelon, into more army bases. We've seen the plans. So my estimation, very guesstimation, is really the number really would have been 15,000 or 20,000. That's why even when you talk about the civilian casualty against the amount of people died, it's not really, in a certain way, it's not the right way to look at it, in my humble opinion, because I don't want to get to the politics so much, that's not what everybody came to hear, but because it's what they, obviously what happened is important, but it's what they wanted to happen. You know, the plan was a much worse plan, yeah? Zikin Beach, does the name Zikin Beach mean anything to anybody? Zikin Beach? Imagine if October 5th someone came to you, right? September 5th someone said to you, there's a beach north of Gaza, and that terrorists attacked the beach massive terrorists. 35 people died, and the army base that's behind the beach, 8 people died, right? Altogether, I would tell you 43 people would have died there. That would have been one of the worst things in Israeli history. Such thing like that. Guess what? That happened October 7th. And you don't even know it. You know why you don't know it? Because it paled in comparison to everything else that most people don't even know that story. And I only knew the story because I happened to be watching a lot of videos. And I actually emailed to give chizuk, and I dedicated a shir to one of the Chaylim that fell in that historic breach. But that shows you how bad it is. Something that would have happened in September, we would have still been talking about it. You guys didn't even know what happened. And I happened to know what happened because I was, you know, there and watching. But you don't even know that happened. North of Gaza, there's a beach called Zikim Beach, and they attacked on the beach, and they would have killed a lot more people. And again, the same type of story. There was tremendous heroism, which held back a much worse catastrophe. And we know today the horrific nature. If you could see it I suggest again you see these videos also. You can see videos of the older men of Zaka, which is the, everyone knows what Zaka is. You see them breaking down, 50, 60-year-old Haredi guys breaking down when they describe, breaking down, crying like babies when they talk about what they went through. Doctors in Abu Kabir, you know what Abu Kabir is? That's where they identify the dead. Talk about their experience. You don't have to hear about the actual horrific thing. But, I spoke to Chayal who said he saw people beheaded. He said, he told me he saw it, which I'll get back to that. Yeah, but I got very interesting. He also said that when he was in Gaza, he saw a terrorist coming out with only his underwear, and suddenly a sniper shot him. I didn't know why the sniper shot him. He said, look in his bag. He had a grenade. The guy told me the story. He said he had a grenade in his underwear on the back. So the plan, he was coming out like this, but he was going to flick the grenade. So now, sexual atrocities I don't want to talk about, but I can tell you things that tour guides told me that they heard, if you want, not for public, but if anybody asks me, I'll tell you. So now, why am I telling you all this? Because please listen for a moment. This is important. This is important to note because we are Jews and we are humans. Jews, humans. As Jews, we are Rachmanim v'nei Rachmanim. We're merciful, the son of the merciful. Very much in the Jewish nature. Shalosh Simanim, the Gemara in Yevamos tells us, Shalosh Simanim b'umazeh, Rachmanim v'ashanim gomli chasadim. We have an embarrassed nature in a good way. We're merciful and we do chesed. That's what it says. That's the science. David HaMelech saw the Gibonim that wanted to kill B'nai Shaul, son of the Shaul, and he said that these guys are not for us. And he said, we're not taking any converts from them because they don't fit the bill for what a Jew should be. That's the Gemara. So we're Rachmanim. So as Rachmanim, we are, David HaMelech says, Ani Shalom v'chi adaber heim l'mocham. I'm a man of peace, but they speak to me war. So we're naturally peace-loving. That's in the Jewish DNA, to be peace-loving. We want to forget. We want to live. I was just in Berlin 2 days ago. We want to get radicalized, and I emphasize radicalized. Arabs, another chance. But that's a problem. And as humans, we forget. We're just naturally forgetful. People don't live with lessons of history. And the human nature is to forget things. They don't really want to kill us. They aren't really that bad. Give them a chance. And I emphasize the radicalized ones. Friends, and this is my opinion, my reflection, don't forget, right? Because anyway, anyone listening knows they want to do the same thing again and again and again. I took two anecdotal videos, but you can see the people of Hamas saying it. But I saw videos of young Arab girls, I think specifically in England. One was saying, nothing can take this, with glee, like the Super Bowl. If you were the Chicago Cubs finally winning the World Series, anybody Cubs fans know it took them decades and decades and decades until they finally won in 2006. Now, sports guys, I don't know when they won, but already when I was, just went to baseball, right? But nothing can take this day away from us. Whatever happens, we might not win for another 100 years, but that World Series is ours. That Super Bowl is ours. That's with the glee. You can find it online. Another one saying, girls, women in England, we're going to do it again and again and again. And I only bring that anecdote, but it's a sign of what many people think. So form your opinions you like, and I'm not telling anyone what opinions you have to form. But what is a terrible thing to do is to ignore reality. Every person has to understand what reality is. There was a certain reality which was revealed here. And you have to see that reality when you form opinions, right? And when you ignore reality, you do it at your own peril. You don't put a seatbelt on when you're traveling. Again, how you form your opinion, I'm not telling you what to do, but this day has to be etched in everyone's consciousness as something real that happened and that can continue to happen. I would say included in that is to know how much Iran was behind all this. Now, that I don't know is factually, but everybody knows Iran is, the Hamas is the long arm of Iran, and Hezbollah is a proxy. That's this common knowledge. And, as U.S. citizens, I think we have to make a point of that. However we can influence U.S. foreign opinion and policy, you have to take that in mind. And you do. If there are people who are behind Iran, in whatever way they're behind it, So you're voting for that if you vote for them or whatever. You know, but just I'm not telling you what to do. You could say because of X, Y, Z, whatever. That's but know the reality. People love to ignore reality. People, alcoholics, it takes them a very long time. Everybody knows. When does an alcoholic finally realize? When he hits rock bottom. We hit rock bottom. We are alcoholics. So you have to face the reality of this thing. Okay. All right, back to this. The first few days after the 7th were crazy for everyone. I had, as a reshiva, I had a special craziness and had a, and whether I should cut off vacation, because in Israel, here, but we have Simchas Torah, and then there's a week of vacation, a nice week. A lot of people, it's like a very beloved week. Kids are away. You know, during the summer, the kids are home. For a babe, it's like a special week. The kids are back in school. The wife is made back at work. I don't know, but, you know, the Rebbe's off. So do I call the yeshiva back or not? I'm going to get back to that. But I want to highlight something you already know and just add a perspective to it. By being one of the most painful times in recent Jewish history, this is also one of the greatest times. Mamish. The whole country is getting together with a shared purpose. Ki'ish echad v'lev echad. Right, left, center. And you have to appreciate that. You have to appreciate how deep the schism was in Israeli society pre this. Right? Young men and women returning from Thailand to serve 150% or higher of milum nikum, turning up for duty. Chesed galore, a tremendous amount of charedim pitching in their way. It wasn't just, though, that we were together for shared purpose, and we are. It was a greatness of that shared purpose. You know, in our short stay in this world, you may shivim shana, we're here for 70, 80 years, now with modern medicine a little bit longer, on this planet. We're here to destroy the bad and build up the good. That's really our purpose in life. As Torah Jews, we always know that, and we're always involved with that, and including to centrally build up the goodness in ourselves and the badness in ourselves, you know. My Rebbe Mendel Blachman, someone asked him one time, where is Amalek? He said, look in the mirror. That was, you know, I don't speak like that, but that's what he said this time. The Ramchal discusses this in Das Tfunis and Derech Hashem, the idea of, especially in Derech Hashem, of the Bir Hara. We're here to make Birurim, to get rid of the Ra. It's Otis, all that stuff, right? That's our whole purpose, is to be Mesalik Ra and to be Megadol Tov. Kol Echad Lefi Darko. Yeah? Mitzaseh, Mitzaseh, Lo Taseh. That's really, in a certain broad way, what we're here for. So this is on a totally different level. I mean, this is like a Amalek. This is raw. This is sudden. This is cruelty. This is barbarity. This is like, you know, that's why I'd like to talk about the numbers and not the horrifics, because the horrifics catch people a little bit more, and I'm not going to go more into them. But that, I think it does show something poignant about it. This is really raw. And the beauty was, you had all of Israeli society, and you have all of Israeli society, it's a very large thing, still like unified in this Bir Hara, which really means like, in a greater way, the whole Israeli society, religious, non-religious, is unified in the Tachlis HaBriyah, which is very cool, right? So, you know, you don't have to be a big Baal Musar and Oved Hashem to get it. I would say you have to be a normal human being, but many people don't get it, right? Either because of, my people, it's wickedness, it's naivete, or it's some combination of both. Shmuel Orbach, a famous gadol, a little bit of a controversial gadol in Shlomo Zalman's son, in Israel, said that in every community you have the good guys, you have the bad guys, and you have tamimim, you have naive people. And you can deal with the naive people, and you can deal with the wicked people. The problem is when the wicked people and the naive people get together, then you have a problem. Yeah, think about that. So that's what he said. So that's kind of what's going on. I personally encouraged some of my Talmidim, the ones that were up for it at the time, whatever, that had the means, to be engaged in the social media PR war for Israel. And part of the reason was because of that. My own feeling was because I feel like there's these, you know, there are people who are write out anti-Semites or radicalize Islam in different degrees. You're not going to talk to them. But a lot of people on the fence, and those people, Jews and non-Jews, I felt like you have to save them. That's how I look at it. You know, it's like saving them and getting these people on the right side of history and not the wrong side of history. It's, you know, time to make a choice. By the way, more intelligent people got a long time ago. You know, is this Germany in 1938? That you hear that question come up. So I don't think so. But I do believe we're in a worse place than Germany, 1865, 1870. I heard a lecture recently by a historian that said that a lot of the precedents for Nazi Germany were really happening. The term anti-Semitism is a unique term created in Germany. I forgot the name of the guy, around 1870. There was a Austrian paper, I think, called Der Stürmer, which was the name adopted by Joseph Goebbels, took a lot of his vitriolic straight from that paper that was in the 1870s, right? And the 1870s, you can check all this. I'm happy that anybody asks, I could send you a lecture, not a mind of you to Geber, going into this, all this. He says, where did it start? Listen to this. It started before 1870 in Germany in the universities. What was the first thing which moved Herzl to Zionism? Everybody knows it was the driver's trial. No. The first thing that drove him, that's what everybody says, the first thing that drove him to his state was when he was kicked out of a fraternity as a Jew. That was his first significant meeting of anti-Semitism. The Dreyfus trial brought it home to him in a much stronger way, and that's what historically stood out, but that was it. So it's this combination of universities. Now, why do I say it's worse? Because we have the Tmimim, we have the Stam anti-Semites, and then you have radical Islam, which is all over. Now, let's say someone like, a lot of people have been on the case of radicalism for years. I know I was talking about it 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I'll tell you one thing. I had heard an expert speak one time, and he said, this is maybe 12 years ago, 15 years ago. He said there was a, Mattel is a toy company. He says there's a little bit of there's a doll that if you press the button, the doll says, I'm, right? But if you slow it down, it says Islam is light. That's shocking. It means there's someone very high up in Mattel who has an Indian to get little kids to believe that Islam is light. Exactly what he said. Okay? And radical Islam is taking on many forms, but the global program is the same. It's a question of how far you go. But the idea of wanting a caliphate and wanting, you have to understand that. A lot of the people you run into, they're nice, regular Arabs who are living their life and just want to pray to, you know, worship God in there, make their buck, let their families be religious. But there is many different forms of this thing that really want to run the world. That's a reality. Okay, Neville Chamberlain goes down in history as one of the most foolish people in history. 1938, comes back, peace in our times. We'll cede the Sudetenland to Hitler, and then it will calm down, right? If you know that. But he looks like a fool, absolute fool. In hindsight, he's a fool. When Neville Chamberlain, in fact, was a very, very wise politician. He was a very good politician, a very brilliant guy. But Hitler fooled him. So, and the only person who saw was, of course, my pick for the great men of the 21st century, perhaps centuries before that, Winston Churchill, was in political wilderness in the 30s. But he saw the threat of Nazi Germany. So I'm just bringing that, you know, those who don't learn from history are going to suffer from its thing. So you have to understand, just like people didn't see it back then, and they blinded some for different reasons. And read the history. Don't trust me. Read Churchill's, it's a very good book, The Last Line. There's a whole volume about his political, I forget what the name, who wrote the book. Three fat books on Churchill I wrote, but one is all about that period. He had like his own little secret service. He had people under, but the only world leader who was actively anti-Hitler strongly then was one guy who was in political wilderness. The only reason he came back was because of Chamberlain's mistakes, but otherwise we wouldn't know who Winston Churchill was. He would have been another, you know, Boy George or something like that. That's it. Anyway, so, and it's incredible to me personally, just after 1911, that so much of the world fell asleep. Okay, let's move on. So we're living in Israel in this amazing time. A Rebbe in yeshiva visited his son at the base, and I want to show you some stories that I know firsthand to bring that point up. And he said, "I didn't recognize my son. You know, his fortitude, his drive, his passion." I said it was like a different kid that I was talking to. This is before they went in. And an officer drove this Rebbe to Be'er Sheva. He had to fix his glasses. And he said, "Look, I want you to know something. I'm Chiloni. I'm secular Jew. I have a wife. I have children. I have a good life. I'm here to die. You know, I am ready to die for this cause." That was, you know, that's this is what I heard myself. Okay, so back to what we did as a Rosh Yeshiva. In the few days after the attack, we called the guys back to Shiva early, a pretty obvious choice. That was one thing to remember. I was asked about that. But more importantly was focusing myself into the yeshiva to what our role was. This is what I spent a lot of time thinking about. Like, what's our role? Of course, to be nosebol, to realize the tragedy that's going on and to dig into that's obvious. But more importantly, that's not a role per se. That's a feeling. That's a mussar. I have to feel for the people who are suffering, people getting evacuated, like that. Do we go down south? Do we build fences? Do we pick lettuces? Do we go into the greenhouses? There's so many things to do. So I personally, I'm sharing my reflections here, I waited very strongly as fellow Hanhala members of the yeshiva, was to realize our base medrash, our learning, our davening is a vital part of the battle. That was how I looked at it. That's how I looked at it personally. That's what I tried to lead the yeshiva to realize that and to try, in my humble way, and to have the yeshiva step up to that and have the Talmidim internalize that. Not as a slogan, not as a cliche, not as a statement, but to realize we're doing our part of the battle here. The Pasuk says, Gemara Makkah says that we stood in Yerushalayim b'schus the learning. So Chazal clearly, many Chazals clearly indicated this Chazal Sarna, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chevron Yeshiva, met Ben-Gurion after the Six-Day War. The Ben-Gurion at Kavarach of all places. Ben-Gurion turned to him and said, what do you think about my army? So he said, you have to realize, without my, I'm just saying the way it's brought down, he said, without my learners, your army wouldn't have been successful. That's what, you know, Ben-Gurion wasn't going after him and hit him right back between his. As Chazal say, if the non-Jews knew how much the Korbanot protected them, they wouldn't challenge the Beis HaMikdash. They would send forces to protect the Beis HaMikdash. The Korbanot of Sukkot, of course, the Pari HaChag. Revolva writes that if the secular realized how important the yeshivot were for their protection, they wouldn't challenge the yeshivot. They would send, he borrowed that terminology, that formulation, they would send troops to protect the yeshivot. Rav Kook, if anybody wants to see really Bahar Chava, Rav Kook has amazing letters during the First World War to exempt the yeshiva students. Again, I'm pretty sure during the First World War was what it had to be. But he has, goes on and on and on. Anybody wants to see it, I'm happy to get those sources. Rav Kook has in his letters, has a whole beautiful letter. It's like 4 pages, 5 pages, going on and 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 on about the importance of learning. We personally extended Night Seder in yeshiva, and I advise Talmidim to try to learn Beretzi Food, to learn without interruption, an hour in the morning, an hour in the afternoon, night. That was, you know, to try that. And that's how we attached ourselves to the great battle in a real and meaningful and hopefully beneficial way. Personally, it was very beneficial to me personally. You know, I felt myself, and I share this lesson, like I said, I want to speak honestly and openly. You know, as a high school guy, I was a big sports guy, actually an all-star who lost to MTA on those, you know, that very court, or at least what was that court, I don't know if they've redone it, and many other schools. I basically totally fell out of sports for like 20 years. And then there was a Rebbe in Eish HaTorah was actually Mekalkel me. He ruined me because he told me about, yeah, I know you guys know football, but he told me about the amazing, you like football? No, anybody a sports guy here? He told me about the amazing Patriot comeback, I think, in the Super Bowl. They were behind 25-3 and they came back, tied the game, won the game, and I had to check that game out. And that kind of like was, that ruined me. So I never watch a full game, but I'll watch clips and things like that. There are many times during the year when I don't. Right? As a Rashiv and from guy, during Yellow I try less, or the Sphira, or the 3 weeks, obviously. You know, it's not like, I don't think a person has to have control over these things. And it's not, that's how I am. But I could watch, I don't mean on Yom Kippur, Arab Yom Kippur, right? But I could watch. It's like a religious thing for me not to watch. I tell you, honestly, as I stand in front of you, I don't remember such a thing since I had like no desire, no time to know what was going on in the NFL. Zero. It was meaningless to me, and I know a lot of people had that feeling. Like, oh, let's see how the Steelers are doing, who's in the playoffs, what happened with Aaron Rodgers and the Jets. Like, it just, when people are terribly bleeding with the captives or who knows where and who knows what condition, it didn't matter to me. And Baruch Hashem, that lasted for me for quite a time, and it was like a precious time. We'll talk more about that. You know, you have to ride a wave in things. That was a precious time that I had that feeling. And, you know, just for the football fans, like, after I decided, at a certain point, that feeling waned by me. But I said, you know, I made it through this much of the season without football. I'm going to have a football this season. And thank God I did. And I wouldn't have even known who was in the Super Bowl besides the fact that Alan Gondra came into yeshiva with his I didn't even know if it meant that they won the Super Bowl. Then I realized after they won the AFC. I didn't even know who was in the NFC for, like, 2 weeks afterwards. I by now I put together, but I haven't watched a clip about it, you know. I'm talented in sports. I figured it out. So back to focusing, right? We spoke about remembering the fact, the captives. I was able to write a tefillah for the captives. I don't know if you guys saw it. Anybody wants it, you know, email me. I'm happy to share my prayer. And, of course, we spoke about our mighty warriors all the time, the incredible Mesiras Nefesh of the soldiers, and the otherworldly Yekaras HaTov we have to have to them. Those were the themes that were, you know, by myself and others in the yeshiva that we were emphasizing all the time. And I tried to strike a difficult balance, which I think is true. You know, I think an emissary person has to totally appreciate what the Chayilim are doing and see their Mesiras Nefesh on a different level. And together with that, to realize that our role as B'nai Torah, as yeshiva students, is vital and not feel guilt. You should feel inspired. You feel pushed. You should feel ambitious. But you don't have to feel guilty. You know, my Rebbe of Leichter spoke about this in general. A person has to have his role. You can't, it's too much. You know, just in general, we can be moved by things, but then it's like ruts of a shove. You have to be moved to a place of, okay, now what's my role in all these things, right? If the artillery guy feels bad and leaves his post because, look, my friends are in a more dangerous situation than me, he's going to do bad for the infantry because infantry needs artillery. So he's like, what are you doing here? Why are you, where are the bombs? I felt bad for you guys, so I had to come on the front line. Like, what are you doing? so too for his intelligence guy. Like, the intelligence guy is saving the infantry guy. The infantry guy doesn't have, he's, it's true, intelligence is not usually not as dangerous as infantry, but he can't take that feeling in a rational way and leave his post. So I think that's similar to how I see the role of those who are learning. Now, intense feelings wane. I think that's natural and okay. Before getting to that, I want to share just a little bit more on the amazing spirit that reigned and still remains, although not as dominantly as before. You know, I don't think the feeling in the country is as, but it's still there. I'll just give you some short examples. So we'll be done in about 10 minutes. So this is from actually Talmud and Yeshiva. You guys know him, Avi Lewis? He's in Sheldag, which is one of the top units, top four or five units in the army. So this guy's like, he's working for Google. He's a top-level guy in a top-level unit, all right? And he's a close Talmud of mine, and close Talmud of Chappelle's. Very proud of him. So he wrote this for the Times of Israel in an Israeli paper. I've never been more hopeful for Israel's future. So I'm not going to read the whole thing, but listen to just a little bit. And again, I'm drawing on anecdotes that I saw to bring it home. Whatever I saw is happening all over the place. Prat hayotzim neklal lamed ala klal kulo yatsa. A detail leaves the general principle teaches about this. So the fact that I'm running into people like this means that there are a lot more people like that. I'd happen to run into the few amazing people. I always knew we had the best, but it took being on base to get their mind from the inside. So again, he's in a top unit. Means top Israeli guys, or you know, the top probably 0.3% of Israeli society, or 5%, you know, 1 in 200 in his unit, something like that. Sheldag. Take for example all the Jews and Israelis abroad that paused their lives to catch the flight home. Here are some personal examples of guys from my unit that I serve with. Tom is completing his medical residency as a heart surgeon in Toronto. He left behind his wife and young kids to don the IDF uniform. Noam is a serial entrepreneur, former big tech VP, and successfully led a $1 billion exit as CEO of one of Israel's most famous startups. He swapped his apartment in Manhattan for a tent and black coffee in the field. Naor left his medical studies in Italy. Tomer was vacationing with his wife in Paris. Ron left his startup in Boston. He's CEO. Gabriel was hiking in Greece. Elad was wrapping up a postdoc in physics at a world-class university. And so many more. These are just a handful of folks that I served with that dropped everything the moment they knew they heard their country was in need. There are many thousands more in every unit, every battalion, and of every rank. Okay, now this is from our executive director, our Javelin's son. And someone that we know, someone that I know, one example of many. You should know that my soldier and I are going to truly live this moment. We will win at any price and will not hesitate. This is our land and there's no greater goal than this. Listen to this, it's so... Know that if something should happen, do not be sad because I fell in happiness on the land that I love so much. Do not worry about me. Continue to grow and develop in our land. Abba, what excitement. We have reached the Sea of Gods. This is a few weeks, months later. I remember as a child during Birkan Amazon, I saw the pictures in Birkan Gush Katif and dreamed of going back there. Inside, I knew that one day this vision would come true and I would be there. I wish you could be with me in these moments. I said Shechianu in my name and in the name of the whole family. So these are people I know. I saw a video, a discussion, exactly the discussion. A chayal is talking to his friend. I went in already. You know, I was the first one into X home. I know how to do it. I'll go first. The other guy says, no, it's my turn. You went in first before. Yeah, guys, you know what it means to go in first. That means your chance of coming back in a bag goes up unfold times. But that's the discussion. They're fighting over who's going in first. I went already. I have the experience. You went already. I have to take the experience. Now listen to this. It gets more. You have four kids. Right? It's more dangerous for you. It means more. I only have two. I have four kids. I've already have a family. I have something to leave behind. You'd have to establish your family. I'll go first. Exact video. Happy to send it out. Mind-boggling. So I said the feelings wane. What's our reaction to that? To feel bad? I don't think so. And this is an important thing. I don't see doing anything. Intense feelings wane, you know? In marriage, you're infatuated when we first get married, it wanes. It's like, you know, it's going to go to the infatuation thing. People are always looking for the infatuation. That's why sometimes people cheat on their wife. No, don't do that. Because it's going to, I mean, not you guys, right? I think it's an important thing to spread a knowledge for the world to know that that's called, there's an infatuation cycle that lasts like 12 to 18 months, and then you're not infatuated anymore, whoever it is, right? It just doesn't work like that. So but feelings wane. And I don't think it's helpful to feel bad about it. Why could I imagine myself seeing a football video? Because, you know, life went on. It could be someone really learns a lot of Musar and a lot of Hasidus and sits all the time. I don't know, I'm not such a guy. But normal people who aren't really, really trained themselves, feelings get less. We don't feel Yom Kippur the whole year. We have highs and lows. But I think, here's the important thing. I think this is a big lesson. That's really what I share lessons as we begin to finish up. Ride a nice wave as long as possible. You know, when you're feeling a good wave of Avodas Hashem, when you're feeling a wave of Hakar Zatov, when you're feeling a wave of intensity, when you're feeling a wave, you ride it. You know, a person doesn't not go out because he says, look, I'm going to go out to eat. And we spend a lot of money. The meal's going to end. Why go on vacation 2 weeks? We're going to be back home in 2 weeks, right? Why am I going to Paris? I'm going to be back. Why read a book if I'm going to forget it? Why beat the Yitzhahara if I'm going to fall the next time? There's a value in living those moments and riding the wave. You know? And one, for the good things produced, right? I tell you, at a certain point, there was a word that the worst fighting was happening at 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. So I took with an old Talmud of mine from Chappelle, from Eshet Torah, we took on that time. I learned from 11 to 2, and he learned from 2 to 5 for Ritzifus. Now, I couldn't keep that up. I think he kept that for a week. I kept it maybe for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You know, it crushed me. But okay, you know, it was great while it lasted. So because I can't always be like that, don't take away what you've accomplished. Two, by living at that level, it shows you what you can accomplish. You know, I don't think this guy knew that he could learn without interruption from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., but he did it. You know, so you see, you do it. The more, a lot of our spiritual life, our religious life, is just knowing we can do things. David HaMelech says, when it's come to kill Goliath, what does he say? Hashem will help me? No, you know what he said? Gam esari, gam esadov, he gets esavdecha. I've done this before. I can handle Goliath. I've taken on bears. I've taken on lions. And I won. Right? So David HaMelech is showing us this lesson of, obviously, B'siyat D'Shmaya, but that we, by drawing on where you've accomplished, you know you can accomplish it in the future. That was Reb Leifu's insight. So, you know, one other last point, and I'll talk about going to the south. You know, this is a great time of Achdus, and we were hoping to be part of a historic Achdus event. You guys saw it, but there was a little history. You know, the main Baal Tshuva yeshivas were once, and really a lot of Baal Tshuva yeshivas have had a whole effect on the whole world. We don't have time to go into that now. But there was a time when there were, you know, great men of a certain time and type, Noach Weinberg, Carl Rosenberg, Rav Nachman Shon, Mendel Weinbach, had very different versions of what the purpose of a Baal Tshuva yeshiva was and what it was about. Chappelle's was a later spinoff. And eventually split up, and they formed Eshet Torah and Or Sameach and the Machon Shlomo, which is the Machon Yaakov, and eventually Shabbos came along also. And not getting into that, but you know, unfortunately, as very often happened, it wasn't just an ideological split. Everybody walked away friendly. There was, you know, this, it's no secret that there was institutional angst, if we will. And we saw a historic opportunity because everybody's talking Achdus to bring everybody together. So some heads of institutions. We planned together. Myself was involved. My friend David Rasser from Eshet Torah, from Machon Yaakov, Machon Shlomo. We had Yosef Flynn and others. And from Or Sameach, we had Rav Schiller's son, Shlomi Schiller. And we really planned an event together. And we had an event, and all the heads of the yeshiva spoke, and we had a kumbis. And it was historic. So, you know, just like riding the wave. Things open up. Every opportunity in life has difficulty. You know, one can look at just the darkness of October 7th and coming afterwards. One of the most important reflections I can share with you guys, which I'm sure you've seen also, is the good that came out of this thing is just, it's mind-boggling. The Chizuk and Emuna, I'm not even going into that. You know, the guys with ponytails without kippah, with tzitzis around, which are ubiquitous in Israel today, and the Chizuk and Shabbos, the Chizuk and Achdus, you know, every situation in life is like that. On March 11th, this will be my last point, we took the yeshiva down south. If anybody makes it to Israel over this time, I highly suggest it. It's really, it brings the Chorban home. I mean, you see 900 cars, some of them looking decades old and charred. You can't believe they're from only 3 months ago. I mean, it looks like they've been there for 50 years. Bullet holes, airbags. There was a GMC Savannah with its roof totally blown off to one side. They got RPG. I mean, think of what happened in there. 8 people died there. We went to Kibbutz Nirim. Now, this is amazing. Okay, so the smaller kibbutz, not as known an event. There were 8 people fighting against 65 terrorists, and you know only 5 people died. I think 6 were taken captive from there. Only, I say, Sagrayim, But the contrast, and the fighters that were there were talking to them. This is real. It's not a video. This is like that guy, those guys, Daniil, I'll talk about it in a second. It sounds what's going on. He says that there's one family that had was positioned at this point in the kibbutz. They decided their strategic position would be there, here, in point A. Point B was less strategic for them, but they gave up on their better position to be in a place where they could protect this couple that was holed up in this house, and they had a little kid with breathing problems, and there was smoke all over, and they kept sticking their kid out the window to take a few breaths and bring him in danger. That was our position. The Hamas guys are sitting opposite them, 150 yards around the decks, and they sent in their civilians to go scout the camp. And they point out the contrast. We were endangering ourselves for our civilians, and they're using their civilians as cannon fodder to send out the camp. You know, it sounded like they were without weapons, and there were thousands or hundreds and hundreds of civilians, Gazans, that came in, and these guys were walking through. So that was just a shocking thing. We met a true hero. I have a picture with him. I put on my status one time. You ever saw? Named Daniil. And he was called the Rav Shatz, the first responders. He's in charge of the first responders and that. And he was, Mamish Moshe Nevesh for hours and hours and hours. And thank God he lived to tell the tale. They also point out that right here, this is where Asaf Hamami was like the highest ranking person who died. He was a colonel or a half general, I don't know exactly. He died. The other show is he died here. Like, this is where he died. So, unfortunately, kibbutz were closing up, so by the time you get there, you might not be able to get in. They said this question. One thing about this Daniil, which is amazing, is that he was living on a secular kibbutz, not a religious guy, and he said, they used to call me Donnie. He said, I don't want to be called Donnie anymore. Danny, call me Daniil. He said, why? I heard it. I didn't get it. And I'll tell you the full story. I didn't plan on saying this just because of the crowd. He said, because I don't want to, after what I saw on October 7th, I don't want to take the Shem Hashem, the Aleph Lamed. I don't want to be called Danny anymore. I want to make sure I'm always referred to with the Shem Hashem, with the Aleph Lamed in my name. Rabbi Haber heard that. He broke down crying when he heard that. Mama, she was sitting next to him. He started crying. So a highlight for me was the schus to speak in the very Migunit. Migunit, you know what Migunit means? There was there are bomb shelters. So they're like, not bomb shelters. Things against shrapnel. Like a bomb shelter, right? On the side of the road. And there was one where many people were died in, and we put the yeshiva in as many as probably 20, 25, 30, 30 people were stuffed in there. You can see pictures of this. They have pictures. I don't have one, but they have pictures. And there was a fellow named Aner Shapiro who gave his life there, and I was zocheh to speak there, which was chilling. He said, and I want to take a lesson out from him, that he put everybody in the back, and he stood in the front. And he was at the party like everybody else at the party. He was also in a high-ranking, a top unit. But he was off duty. I think he was at the party, and he was just close to the party, like 5 minutes away. And they're all hiding in this thing. He said they're going to start throwing grenades in, and I'll get them and I'll throw them out. Could you imagine? And he was over to save 7 people, end up living. He threw out, they think, 7 grenades. The 8th one killed him. You could see it. And I spoke about him. What's the lesson? Obviously, his bravery is enormous, to be off duty and sacrifice yourself. But the point I want to bring out, which I mentioned there, was his calm. We get undone by any little thing. No chimichurri for my hamburger? For my vegan burger? What's up? Why do we go to this restaurant? And he kept this cool and saved his life against so much going the other way. I'll share one quick final chiddush. You have to know, and here I'm going to ask everybody humbly to take on a certain hanhaga, which I try to do myself. If you want to do it, do it. This is a historic battle with biblical roots. You can read about it. And I'll tell you one pick of the rule. After Yishmael left Avram. And that's all we really see of Avram Yishmael. And Yishmael, of course, came to the burial and did some type of tshuva because he put Yitzchak in front of him, which we're waiting to see the Maaseh Avot Simon Labonim every day. But Avram, the Medrash says, visited Yishmael. Very interesting. 3 years later, he went on a donkey, and Sarah said to him, Avram, you can go, but don't get off the donkey. You didn't want Avram spending too much time with Yishmael. She didn't want it because she knew that Avram had a certain netiyah, a certain proclivity to Yishmael. He said, don't get off the donkey. Avram goes, and he asked, unbeknownst to Yishmael, wasn't there, And his wife was there. He says, do you have some, can I have some bread and water? He said, no, we don't have any. So he said, okay, tell Yishmael that an old man came, and he gave him like some remez that meant to get rid of her, because she's not a balas chesed. And he did. Avram comes back 3 years later. He has a new wife named Fatuma, which I think Muhammad's daughter was named Fatuma based on this medrashim. The Radal, Rav David Luria, was a phenomenal, phenomenal, phenomenal scholar, knew everything. It's incredible. His perish on the Pirkei of the Rabbalazar. It's really a real work. You want to see Mamish Omen al Dover Kotan Dover Kotan, something else. He says that Muhammad, I think he's talking about Muhammad. He says the Muslim lawmakers, I think it means Muhammad, took a lot of Midrashim. So he thinks that he named his daughter Fatima based on this Midrash. Anyway, so then this Fatima is Yishmael's wife. And the same thing, don't get off the donkey. Do you have bread and water? You have bread and water. Yeah, she does. Avram then gives a bracha to Yishmael. Do you ever hear this medrash before? Avram then gives a bracha. You should have a kol matzei yadecha, should be matzleif, something like that. Now, why Avram is doing so much for Yishmael, I don't know. That bothers me, okay? But that's not my point. The Pirkei of the Rabbalazar says, what's going on? He says, Avram wanted to be mevorach Yishmael. And Yishmael has kel. Everybody talks about Yishma kel, about the shmi aspects. I'm sure you heard they're going to make us daven and sof yomim. He says another thing. He says, the chesed of Yishmael is real. El, Hashem, Hashem, El Racham Achanan, Kel Racham Achanan. Kel is one of the shemas of Chesed, right? So, to the two nations which have Chesed in them is Yishmael and Yisrael. We have a netiyah towards Chesed, and they have a netiyah towards Achnas Orchem. So Avram was waiting, the first wife, Ein Bracha Shruya Tov Beisa Shalodim Elab Svut Ishto. So Avram knew that this first wife, I can't give a bracha to Yishmael when he's got this cheap wife. Now I see Fatuma, she's a Balad Chesed, now I can give the bracha. And the Radal says, you see, Adiyom Azeh, that the Arabs are have a lot of hachnas zorchim. Right? Everybody knows, bring them into the tent. He says, even the Arab robbers will they might kill you afterwards, but they will give you, you know, they'll give you the lechem, the water, and the bread. So why do I bring all this? Yishmael has schusim. They have a schus, right? There is our respondent. There is something going on. This was, you know, from a religious Jew's perspective, it's insane what happened. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. The defense goes, army's gone. There are a lot of, I don't even go into that. The hours late, I've gone past the time. You know, this is there was a horus ponim. I don't think you have to be a very big ma'amin to believe that, but it's obvious to me there was a horus ponim to Yishmael. Why? I don't know. So I think, this, I don't know if you guys are like this, but once a week a person has to do this avoda, to look at how beautiful the Jewish people is, look how messed up these people are, and turn to Hashem and say, God, don't show horus ponim to them. This is a big avoda of Cook writes about it, called Sangarius of Yisrael. Lucius Levy talks about that. A person has to bring out the Shevach of Klal. We all have critical natures. It's a very big avoda. Whether you want to do the other part, I think I'm right. But I personally do this once a week. I try to think of nice things I see in the Jewish people. You know, I try to. And do that because at the end of the day, here's the point, guys. This is a spiritual battle. It's beyond you and me. And it's beyond Netanyahu and Abu Mahdi. And it's beyond Hamas and IDF. This is spiritual underpinnings. There's many, many, many sources from Chaim Vital, from the Pirkei of the Rabbalazar, from Kabbalah, from obvious. Just look, you see, it's history. It gives a lot of emuna, really, when you really look. Galus Yishmael is something that was foreseen and spoken about in many, many, many sources. I have, anybody wants to have a whole list of Marmakomas, and more Marmakomas, which I didn't get to, but there's a lot about this. So that's really, ultimately, that's where we have to battle them on this level somehow. Is that the only way to do it? I don't know, but I have more to say about that, but that's topic. So here are some takeaways and action items that I want to bring out, that we brought out in this talk. Learn the lessons of history. Don't forget them. Don't be stupid. Learn the lessons of history and don't forget them. That is the way an intelligent person is. You have to go against your nature sometimes, and you have to look facts in the face. Facts don't have feelings. Facts are facts. You have to be careful in evaluating your fact. You have to be intellectual. You have to be smart. But it's not smart because something goes against the way we think, that I don't like a certain feeling. Attach yourself fully to the battle of good against evil. What could be better than that? Know what your role is. And if your role is Torah and Tefillah, believe in it and be real with it. Ride good avodas Hashem waves, even though they run out eventually. Right? I would suggest doing this holy avoda once a week, asking Hashem to look at us goodly. Remember the lesson of Honor Shapiro. Stay calm and focused in every situation of life. You won't make mistakes. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to share with everybody. And B'ezrat Hashem, we'll see this battle through the end, and we'll win. All the best, guys.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. you guys.